Florida's Ethics Commission under fire by the state legislature. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime. You can stream the audio live right now on our Facebook page, too. Just ahead, former Jacksonville City Council President Matt Carlucci. He's also chair of the Florida Commission on Ethics. And he's sounding the alarm about pending legislation that could have a chilling effect on the state's ethics work. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, a leading voice with the United Nations visits Jacksonville. The topic, alleviating poverty both here and around the world. Plus, author Robert Gold, and we'll tell you why the state's distilleries are pushing for fewer restrictions on how much liquor they can sell. All of that ahead. But first this hour, the Florida Commission on Ethics is sounding the alarm about proposed restrictions on their independence guaranteed by the state constitution. This Friday, the commission will meet to discuss a move by House and Senate leaders in Tallahassee to place restrictions on their operations. The proposal seen as having a chilling effect on independent oversight of the state's ethical questions in government. Former Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci chairs the Florida Ethics Commission, and he joins us now in studio. Matt, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And now here's our question to callers. How important do you think an independent ethics commission is for the state of Florida? What are your questions? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. You chair the Florida Commission on Ethics, and you've called for a meeting Friday to discuss what's happening. Bring us up to date, Matt Carlucci. What's going on with this?
Well, when I got the memorandum, actually, this is not legislation. This is just the two leaders of the legislature, the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House, Joe Negron and Richard Corcoran, in that order. And it took me a second to look at this memorandum and sink in, and when I saw what they were trying to do, and again, this is not legislation of the whole body. We don't work at the pleasure of the legislature. We are an independent body as spelled out in the state constitution. And so what we got was that the following actions that we might take would require Senate and House approval, and the ones that bother me the most is they want to approve any hiring, terminating, promotion, pay increases, bonuses of commission employees, out-of-state travel of all commission employees, change in our office space. There's other restrictions as well, but actually, it's my opinion, and I'm only speaking for myself, not as the commission as a whole. That's the reason for the workshop this Friday, because I want my fellow commissioners to weigh in with their thoughts. But the independence of the commission to direct our executive director to make those decisions is what's important and what's at stake. And so, for example, just as this is just an example, let's say that one of our investigators who is a commission employee and his support or her support staff were to be investigating a member of the legislature.
And is that happening right now?
Well, it happens often,
yeah.
But it's, I don't know of any right now. But
it could at any time.
Over the past 5 years I've been on the commission, yes, it has happened quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's a conflict of interest, because think if you're the investigator and you're investigating a member of the body who can eventually have a say-so over whether you get fired, whether you get hired, whether you get a promotion. So if you do a really good job, which happens to mean that we find probable cause of an ethical violation with a member of the House or the member of the Senate, that's not a comfortable position for that investigator to be in.
Now, it's your contention that over the years, the state legislature has just been chipping away at the commission's independence. Is it because the commission has been aggressively trying to exercise oversight on ethical problems in Tallahassee?
Well, we do our job, but we certainly don't try to go on any witch hunts or over-exercise our authority. Some people say we don't exercise our authority, and we're not tough enough. We try very hard to be fair, and so no, I don't. That's I just think it's an overreach in power, is what it is. And in all due respect, we do not work at their pleasure. The commission makes these decisions, or we delegate them to our executive director to make. It's micromanagement at the very least.
And we want your calls. How important do you think it is for the state's Ethics Commission to have true independence? Give us a call at 549-2937. And so this sort of came up in the middle of the state legislative session. What do you think prompted it, Matt Carlucci?
I have no idea. I will tell you, I called both the Speaker of the House and the Florida Senate President's office, asked for return calls, did get a return call from the Chief of Staff of Joe Negron's office, did not get a return call from Richard Corcoran's office. We've invited them to come. I'd be surprised if they do, but maybe they'll send staff. But they have no authority to do this, and never have. But traditionally, the executive director has followed these, what they call delegations or directives, you know. But when I saw this, I said, okay, they've crossed the line. And you know what? If I get to heaven and I plan to be there and I see Reuben Askew, and he says, why? On
former governor of the state.
Yeah, and the creator of the Florida Commission on Ethics. And he says, why did you let this independence erode on your watch? And why didn't you fight it? And so I'm fighting it.
Is there a particular case going on that might have led to this move by the House and Senate leadership? For example, there's been a recent ethical question involving Senator Aaron Bean and money he funneled through the Florida State University budget to a concern in his home county of Nassau County. Is there a particular case going on, or is this just something that you think the legislature would like to see this commission have less oversight in general?
I think that elected bodies are generally not warm and fuzzy to ethics commissions, and I don't know of any particular case, no. And it's just an overreach, and I want to know how my colleagues feel. But
and if they agree with you, then what?
Well, I would ask the commission to take a vote in order to re-exert the fact that we are the body that is in charge of the things that the legislature is trying to take away from us.
And could this potentially go to court if the legislature persists with this?
Or? It went to court one time before. And as a matter of fact, it was then former Governor Reuben Askew, spoke up for the commission and spoke against this type of overreach. And so we possibly could go to court, but I don't want it to go to court. I just want them to do their job and let us do our job.
By the way, we have an email from the chair of the Jacksonville Ethics Commission, a local forum established by the local city council to do the same thing locally that you do at the state level. And they send us this message: the Jacksonville Ethics Commission supports the independence of the Florida Ethics Commission, ratified by Florida citizens and mandated in Article 2, Section 8 of the Florida Constitution. Lots of calls for State Ethics Commission Chair and former local city council president Matt Carlucci. How important is an independent ethics commission to you? Give us a call, 549-2937. Let's go to Tom in Orange Park now. Hey, Tom, good morning.
Good morning. My question or my point is independence is independence. When the U.S. won independence from Britain, we didn't continue to take sniping from the British Parliament. We just said, we're independent. Leave it at that.
I think I like exactly what you said, and I might have to use that on Friday.
As you chair this meeting, and do you meet in town? There's even a question about where you meet. Isn't that right?
Well, there's a question of where our offices should be. And
okay.
We feel strongly that our, and I agree with your caller, but our offices should not be in a state building. That's the way the commission feels, because if we are in an office building that has no ties to state government, I mean, if you're charged with probable cause, whether you're guilty or not guilty, and you go to Tallahassee and you have to walk into a state building, which they've tried to get us to locate into a state building before.
And are they trying again right now?
No, but they tried it one time before, and thankfully Will Weatherford, then Speaker of the House, understood the concept of the independence, and he said, no, you guys stay in a separate building away from the state government.
So you meet in Tallahassee, but in a private building?
Well, we meet in Tallahassee in the District Court of Appeals, but our offices are in an office complex sort of like South Point off of Fort Knox Road in Tallahassee.
Lowell in Mandarin. Hey, Lowell, good morning.
Good morning. Basically, I feel that this what you would call an attack on the independence of the Ethics Commission is purely a reflection of the current business model that I think we're seeing coming out of Washington, D.C. today. And it doesn't surprise me, coming from the Tallahassee, that they would attempt to quash any kind of ethics. Appreciate the show.
Okay. Your thoughts on the perception that, and this is true of a lot of state houses around the country, not just Florida's,
right,
but that our state house is, you know, has ethical concerns. Let's put it like that.
I think, you know, serving in this body for 5 years, I think there's ethical concerns everywhere from notary publics all the way, you know, to all levels of government. And that's who we cover. But, you know, I don't see any real otherwise problematic issues with ethics with our state government that prompts me to react to this. It's just, let us do our job as spelled out in the Constitution. And it's sort of like the city charter to Jacksonville is to the city council what the Constitution is to the legislature. And it makes it harder for things to change. And it's there for a reason. So I appreciate the caller's comments.
All right. Tom in Mandarin. Hey, Tom. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you saw this as kind of a larger attack on independent investigation. We're seeing the state Supreme Court coming under an attempt at more control. We're seeing a lot of home rule powers being kind of restricted. And I was just wondering if you saw this as part of a larger grab by the legislature.
That could be possible. We try every year, and successfully, we had some very good reforms a few years ago that hadn't been done in 30 years. We had some good reforms, but the one reform that I personally would like to see, and the commission voted on this as well to support, is our ability to have self-initiation. That is really never embraced by any elected body that I've ever seen. Although our Jacksonville Ethics Commission now has the ability for self-initiation. But the Florida Commission on Ethics has a broader net in accumulating investigations, but we still can't self-initiate, which is something that I think I wish that I could have completed in my 5 years, but I don't have but a few more meetings left.
Oh, you're about to end your tenure.
Well, you actually get 4 years, and somehow I've eked out five, and I got to be chair this year. So either the governor was kind enough to allow me to serve as chair in an extra year, or he forgot to replace me, one of the two. But and let me say this.
So this could be your swan song, then.
Well, it could
dealing
be.
Dealing with this.
It could be. And I want to say this. Say what you want about the governor, but I tell you, he has given me absolute, complete leeway to speak my mind and to do what I think is right. This is a fiduciary duty. I'm no lawyer, but I know fiduciary duty means that you do what you think is right, regardless of the consequences, because that's your duty to the state of Florida, the citizens of the state of Florida.
And lots of calls from Matt Carlucci about this dust-up over the independence of the state's Ethics Commission. Ernie in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how are you doing?
All right.
How are you doing today? I believe that the erosion of the ethics is based on the same thing that's happening in Turkey and Venezuela and everywhere else, every other dictatorship. The people who are pushing this are evil. I'm sorry, but the people who are pushing this are evil, and the man who is with you right now is weak. Have a good day.
Weak, okay. Are you weak? And are they evil?
Well, if you put me on a set of weights, I'm probably weak, but no, I'm not weak at all. I mean, I wouldn't be fighting this if I was weak. But, you know, if that's his opinion, he's entitled to it. And if he'd like to come talk with me sometime, eyeball to eyeball, I'd be happy to challenge him on his
mano
assertion.
Mano a mano. Now, what do you think, though, about some of the calls coming in? People see a parallel between this and the rise of authoritarian dictatorships and power grabs in countries around the world. There's a lot of anxiety about that right now.
Well, there is, but I haven't been connecting those dots. The only dot that I've been connecting has been from the House to in the Senate to the Ethics Commission. That's the only dot that I'm concerned about connecting and disconnecting, as you might say.
Sure. Let's go to Conrad on the north side. Hi, Conrad. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I was wanting to ask Mr. Carlucci. I was there Monday at the Ethics Commission meeting when he walked in. It was somewhat of a surprise. I guess Ms. Miller knew that he was coming in. I don't think anybody else did. But I've worked with the local Ethics Commission for the last 7.5 years, working with Ms. Miller, not a member of the commission. They helped me to formulate our new independent Ethics Commission and the Ethics Code that had been brought back after a 37-year hiatus under her guidance. She had spent probably 10 years as a volunteer, starting with John Delaney and then serving at the behest of Mr. Payton when this was all formulated and voted in 2011, and at her insistence of the need for the independent factor. And I wanted to emphasize that Mr. Carlucci spoke to that the other day at the Ethics Commission, but I wanted to ask Mr. Carlucci if he must have a very valuable ally in Ms. Peterson of the First Amendment Foundation, who is the greatest critic. If there's anybody who's a critic of the ruminations and ponderings of the state legislature, it's Barbara Peterson.
Okay, thanks, Conrad.
Thank you, Conrad, and I want to applaud Mr. Conrad on his involvement with the Jacksonville Ethics Commission, and he is there as a supporter and makes very good observations. No, I don't know Barbara Peterson. This whole thing kind of snuck up on me, but as I understand it, the Speaker and the Senate President jointly send out these delegations or directives annually, but this year they've gone so far that I was a little bit of a slow burn. It took me a second to incorporate what exactly they were trying to do. And when I found it, I said, no, not on my watch. We're going to fight this.
And so you'll meet Friday. How many members on the commission?
9 commission members.
Okay. By the way, here's an email from Rob. I cannot imagine any citizen, no matter what your political affiliation, would not want our government to have an independent oversight committee. If all 9 members, do you need a unanimous vote? What's the procedure here?
I'd love a unanimous vote, but I don't know if we'll get a unanimous vote. Some of these members were appointed by the Speaker and by the House, the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, and some were appointed by the Governor. I was appointed by the Governor, but that might be a little more difficult for them. But
so you need a majority vote.
We need a majority
to do what?
Perhaps in some sort of resolution form, send back a note or a memorandum like we received boomerang it back to the Senate President and the Speaker of the House that the commission makes these decisions, you guys don't.
Well, keep us posted. He's Jacksonville's own Matt Carlucci, former president of the city council. He heads up the state's Ethics Commission. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me, and I hope you have a great and a blessed day.
Much more still ahead later, why the state's distilleries are pushing for more freedom to sell their product. Also, author Robert Gold. But up next, working to bring an end to poverty around the world. Why the United Nations head of advocacy and global health is in Jacksonville.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Environmental activist Tenny White gained a lot of attention helping people in poor black communities.
Their objective was to shut me up. I will not be shut up.
It may have been too much attention.
I think she was set up because she was putting pressure in all the right places.
The story of Tenny White on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT at Fort Caroline Timucuan Preserve on April 29th to explore the outdoors for International Migratory Bird Day. Kids will have the opportunity to become a National Park Junior Ranger, hunt for nature treasures, win prizes, and more. Clifford the Big Red Dog will be on hand with National Park Rangers, teaching families about how to preserve existing natural habitats. This fun family event is free and runs from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Go to wjct.org/events for more information.
What can the Atlanta suburbs tell us about the political direction of the country? Up for grabs is a seat in Georgia that's been controlled by Republicans for decades. It's the kind of wealthy, well-educated district Democrats think they might flip. On the next 1A, could a Democratic upset here also act as a wake-up call for millions who support President Trump and the Republican agenda? The latest, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman.
Welcome back. Well, his emphasis is on alleviating poverty on a global basis. Mike Beard, the executive director for the United Nations Foundation Advocacy and Global Health, speaks today in Jacksonville. It's at the annual forum of the Women's Giving Alliance, and they are focused on breaking the cycle of poverty in our area, specifically female poverty. We have a preview right now as we welcome Mike Beard to Studio 5. Such a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And also in studio, Ellen West of the Women's Giving Alliance. Good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Alleviating poverty around the world. It's the mission of Mr. Beard with the United Nations Foundation for Advocacy and Global Health. What are your questions about that and poverty right here at home? Give us a call, 549-2937. And so your talk today really aligns with the focus this year of the WGA as they look at their big initiative for breaking the cycle of female poverty. This is something, though, that you're looking at in the macro, all around the world. What are going to be some of the points you'll be making today?
Well, you know, if we look at what the Sustainable Development Goals are, and that's what I'll be speaking about, is it's building off of a 15-year plan that started in 2000 around the Millennium Development Goals. And over those 15 years, we saw 600 million people move out of extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. That's 600 million people who no longer live on $1.50 a day or less. And that is an astonishing thing that we have done as a world people, a common humanity,
yeah.
Right? And so over the last 3 years, there was a real attempt to move that forward and have it be about not just what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa or not just going on in India. It's what's going on around the world and in every country. There are still 3 million people that live in the United States that live in extreme poverty. That's under $1.50 a day.
Yeah.
3 million people in the United States. So over the last, since in 2015, the United Nations and all 193 countries came together and said, we want to end poverty in all forms. And we're going to do it by focusing on 17 areas. And if you focus on 17 areas, you're going to work across purposes to actually end extreme poverty, end poverty in all forms. Because we know through the last 15 years that if you focus on education and entrepreneurship, if you focus on global health, you can actually get at some of the, those are the root causes of poverty. And mm-hmm. so let's actually use those, use every tool in our toolbox to be able to yeah. actually get a real progress on ending poverty.
So 17 areas, is education number one?
Number one is poverty.
Number one is just...
is ending extreme poverty. Number two is education. Number three is global health. Gender empowerment, gender equality yeah. is number five. You have sustainable cities. You have... number 16 is something that the U.S. government actually worked a lot on, and that's creating governance structures, making sure that there's transparency, making sure that people have access to the full rights within their the full rights afforded to them by their governments. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that I work on primarily is ensuring that people understand what these are. Everybody says, "Oh, 17 goals. That's too many."
If you right, focus right,
on,
sure.
If you focus on everything, you focus on nothing, right? But if you actually look at how we've made real progress around the world, it's by focusing on one issue and then using different areas to actually come at those issues. So I was talking a few months ago to this gentleman that was working on an HIV/AIDS project in Nairobi. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying is, I can't just be an HIV/AIDS worker. I have to be a transportation worker because I need to be able to get people to my clinic. I need to be an educator because most of my patients are illiterate. Mm-hmm. And I have to make sure that they have access to jobs when they go home because once they get those drugs that they need, we want to make sure that they can live a long and sustainable life. And so that's when we think about what we're doing here in Jacksonville is, and actually I was lucky enough to come down in December to speak with the Women's Giving Alliance and the Council on Foundations, because they had an event where they were talking about how foundation, local philanthropies, can be catalytic in actually driving change within Jacksonville.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking right now with Mike Beard. He's the Executive Director for the United Nations Foundation, looking at advocacy and global health. How to alleviate poverty, extreme poverty around the world. That's the topic of his talk later today at the annual forum of the Women's Giving Alliance. And we'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Ellen Wiss with the Alliance. Your big initiative for the next year is to how to break the cycle of female poverty in our area and in Florida. So everything Mike's talking about, we can learn a lot as you move forward with this. People might not realize how extreme a problem we have with poverty and how deeply it impacts women and children. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's huge. In our country, one in five children face poverty or are living in poverty. In Florida, it's worse, one in four, closer to one in four. And most of those children live in homes headed by single women.
Yeah.
So if you take care of women, you take care of the chunk of poverty, or rather, if you lift women out of poverty, you're pretty much taking care of poverty, because those children are there with them, and yeah, it's huge. And we cannot do it by ourselves. Poverty cannot be owned by one group. It's mm-hmm. all of our responsibility, and that's why we were so excited when we went to this convening in December and heard Mike, and it was actually the Council on Foundations, the Florida Philanthropic Network, and it was hosted by the Jesse Baldupont Fund. And when I heard him speak, and his message was, this will take all sectors working together in order to be successful or have better outcomes, then, you know, I said, I got on the phone, got him back here, and mm-hmm. said, we want your message for our forum so we can speak to everybody. Now and for this panel today, we have different sectors represented. We have the public sector, the mayor's office represented by Dawn Lockhart. We have Darnell Smith, who's the chamber president and also the market president for Florida Blue. So mm-hmm. he's representing the corporate sector. And then we have Dr. Sherry McGill with the DuPont Fund.
And we have lots of calls, meanwhile, for both of you. Let's go to Chris in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Chris. I'm with the Jacksonville Young Democrats, and I am just wondering about the local impact of these discussions. So as we talk about the 17 Millennium Goals, how do we address these goals locally, and how do you guys encourage us to go to our city leaders and talk about poverty in light of the fact that we have growing economic disparities in the urban core? We have the Health Zone 1 that has a the health disparities in our community are just completely awful, and they're always centered in the urban core and in the areas where there is the most poverty for obvious reasons. So how do we take this global conversation, and how do we sort of scale it down to the local?
That's a fantastic question, Chris, and it's something that the world is grappling with right now. One of the brilliant pieces about the formation of these goals was that there was actually local conversations about what do we want to see the world look like in 15 years, and how are we going to actually get there? And it was taking urban experts. I've been working a lot with the Urban Institute up in Washington, D.C. to think about how we can use cities as a real test for how these goals will work. And it's all about data right now. And one of the things that the Secretary General at the time, Ban Ki-moon, had said was, let's start a data revolution. Let's collect data and try to use it and actually learn from it so that our programs can be more effective and better at what we hope that they're doing. One of the things that I think that is really important is that there is so much learning that can be done from other cities, other countries. Case in point is in Baltimore in the 90s, they were actually using a social mobilization program around immunizations that raised their vaccination rates in Baltimore City by 30-40%. They were using something that was coming straight from, I believe it was Tanzania, they were using a program that USAID was doing and raising their vaccination rates. These are things that we should be taking on, and the data points that we have now allow us to learn from other countries in a way that we hadn't been able to before.
Florence is on the east side. Florence, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing? Thank you so much, everybody, for your work. Earlier on, the gentleman made a comment about having to be, you know, I'm a transit worker, I'm a food worker, I'm all those kinds of things. I personally face that. I run a small organization called Character Count here in town that is a restorative workplace. My question really stems around the ongoing challenges of nonprofits to work together. The challenge of trying to be to be everything to everybody because everyone's fighting for a dollar.
Yep.
Versus where I believe we have heavy lifting in our city to do is let someone be the expert in that. Let someone be the expert in that and somehow form better, stronger alliances. So I'd like to hear your insights on what examples of that or examples of other cities who have sort of powerhouse through that. And so, you know, let the people who work with HIV work with HIV. Let's work with the people who need a job, like do the job work. So
such a great question. Yeah, and that's such a big issue. Florence, thank you so much for bringing that up. That is a big problem. What about that? Ellen, you want to talk about that?
So when we're grant makers, and that's one role that we play with the Women's Giving Alliance, and we literally know that success is with wraparound services. And that doesn't necessarily mean that one organization does it all. That means one organization perhaps collaborates with another organization that is expert in a particular component. And we look for that in our grant making because we know that that wraparound service has the best success outcome. So to your point, we have to work together. And if you want money, you better work together and find, you know, who can fill those gaps.
You're trying to set the example so that maybe more organizations
absolutely
follow that model. Yeah. Okay.
And that's research-based. That's why we're doing it that way.
Okay, let's go to Mike along University Boulevard. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to ask with regards to maybe some of the common threads in the causes of poverty. What is causing the issue of poverty? Is it an education issue? Is it a access issue? And what are the common threads between, say, Sub-Saharan Africa, Tanzania, and Jacksonville, Florida, that allow us to learn some lessons from other places? What exactly do we have the potential to learn from these other data sets and these other successes? How can we bring that to Jacksonville?
Sure. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike.
That's absolutely essential to understand, because one of the things that we were talking about, especially last night, was what are the best leverage points? Where should we be investing money? I will say, as somebody that's worked a lot on gender empowerment and women's health, that is one of the big ones. Gender empowerment, ensuring that women have access to markets, ensuring that women have the same rights as men do, that is absolutely essential to create strong societies and alleviate poverty.
And people can learn more about what you're talking about and what the Women's Giving Alliance is doing locally at today's event.
That's right.
Is it sold out? Still tickets? Or
we still have room. So I'm not sure that lunch would still be open for everybody, but as far as coming and being there, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to it myself. It's going
so
to be.
So glad you're going to be there.
Me too. Come on out if this interests you to UNF at the University Center to hear Mike Beer, the Executive Director for the United Nations Foundation Advocacy and Global Health. He'll speak today at the annual forum of the Women's Giving Alliance, the topic alleviating poverty. Ellen Wiss with the Alliance, and Mr. Beer, thank you both. So much interest in this from our listeners. Sorry we couldn't get all the calls on. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, why St. Augustine historian and author Robert Gold is living proof that it's never too late to pursue your passion.
On the next Fresh Air, how and why dictionaries define crude or offensive words like F-bomb and the N-word. Our guest will be Corey Stamper, an associate editor at Merriam-Webster. We'll also talk about adding new words.
I added bodice ripper to the dictionary.
Oh, really?
That's one I added.
Her new book is called Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Presenting Next Avenue, the website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's where grown-ups keep growing. Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
As news breaks on Capitol Hill and way beyond Washington, NPR is busy digging into the details.
This is a failure of policy.
Eliminating the requirement to need 60 votes.
Congress may not be sure whether the FBI.
We're checking the facts, adding context and voices from all sides to help you understand how what's happening affects your life at home. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
We'll have it right here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, piano giant Randy Weston at 90. And I get to hang out with him at his Brooklyn home.
My mother gave me the black church, so I had Panamanian father and a Virginia mama. I'm born in Brooklyn with all the Caribbean and African and all the different people in Brooklyn, you know. So the culturally, it was very rich.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, St. Augustine historian and author Robert Gold is proof that it's never too late to pursue your passion. Gold recently started publishing historic crime stories set in historic St. Augustine and other romantic southern cities. And at the age of 84, Gold has his second novel in print and another one coming out later this month. Robert Gold joins us now in the studio with more about his murder mystery success and the new tale, Dead and Gone. Robert Gold, such a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So in retirement, you decided to pursue a long desired dream. Is that right? To become a novelist.
It is. And I've been a historian for years, but I always loved mysteries, and they were always part of my home life. My father read them, my mother read them, and I decided, well, this is a time, if I'm going to write something that I like, I'm going to write a mystery.
And you have two murder mysteries already in print, Dead to Rights, that's set in Savannah, Cut of the Cross, set in St. Augustine. Your new one, Dead and Gone, is set in New Orleans.
Correct. The third should be out, you said later this month, I hope so. But it may very well be in June. I'm doing the proofreading now, which is a part of the writing I do not like, but it has to be done.
So what attracted you to this genre? And you set your tales in these sort of old southern cities. They lend themselves to these kinds of stories, don't they?
I chose the area, the time and area on the basis of my background. I did most of my research and writing and history in the 18th century in the colonial America. And I have three magical cities. I have Savannah, St. Augustine, and New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And they're all colonial. And though people don't realize it, they all have a deep history that goes back to the 18th century. So St. Augustine, of course, goes back even further. So that was the reason I chose them.
Right. And you're an historian, too. You know so much about the history of these cities, in particular St. Augustine. You know stuff about St. Augustine that I think very few people know.
Well, I'd like to think that, but I'm sure there are many, many other historians in St. Augustine and far from St. Augustine who know a lot about it as well. My focus was on the later part of the Spanish history in St. Augustine, the 18th century, as I said, and particularly the last part of the Spanish period. In 1763, I think you probably know this, everybody moved out. The British took over for 20 years, and St. Augustine would never be as Spanish again after that period.
So how do you weave your knowledge of the history of these cities with a fictional tale that kind of draws people in?
Well, as you said it before, you have to have the idea. The plot must be in your mind. Then you lay it out by simply knowing the history. You set up the environment. You blend in the characters. But you must have the historical knowledge to be able to describe the events and the places and the people accurately. And I try to do that. And where I misuse history, and that does happen, I have an author's comments, and I admit it. You know, in Dead to Rights, this is interesting. I thought, and I had read somewhere, that there were fire ants in Georgia and in Savannah, and they were black, not like the red ones we have in Florida. So I wrote a scene in which the ants are involved in murder, and then as I finished the book, I checked. I was worried about that, and I called a entomologist in southern Georgia state. I'm not sure what it's called now. Anyway, and he informed me, no, the fire ant is not indigenous, but was brought in the 19th...
Invasive species.
Came in from Argentina.
Yeah.
And the same, by the way, is true of our red ants in Florida.
You learned all of this in your research. How old were you when your first novel went to print?
I was 83.
83. And now you're going to have four. Dead and Gone is coming out pretty soon.
That'll be the third.
Oh, the third. And then a fourth book about the history of St. Augustine, right?
Okay. Right.
So when can we read Dead and Gone? Are you going to be doing any book signings?
I'm doing book signing on the Cut of the Cross at the Anastasia Bookstore on San Marco on the 29th of this month. And Dead and Gone is going to be a while. First, it's got to come out, and I'm not sure what I'll do, whether I'll have a signing here or go to New Orleans to do it. I don't know.
What advice do you have for people who think, I've thought about writing, but it's probably too late for me to pursue this? You're living proof that you're inspiring me because I would like to do more writing. It's never too late, is it?
Everybody has a book in them.
Yeah.
I've heard that I don't know how many times in my life. It takes discipline, and mostly it's easier when you're retired. Keep in mind, Melissa, one of the disappointments about retirement is you lose connections with the people you knew. You lose validation. Who am I? How important am I? Well,
you become a PIP, a previously important person.
Exactly, and suddenly yeah. you're nobody. You're invisible, and now if you can write a book that somebody else will read, you can get some people to believe that you're worthwhile again.
Well, you are worthwhile, no matter whether you write a book or not. And I think as a society, we need to change the way we think about that. But in the meantime, I'm so thrilled to meet you and learn more about your writing. And you've inspired me. As I said, I need to retire so I have time to write a book. But that's a ways off. But in the meantime, people could come out and see you at the book signing coming up on the 29th.
Yes.
And it's such a pleasure. He is St. Augustine author and historian Robert Gold. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, this hour, speaking of St. Augustine, the owners of that city's distillery are watching a piece of legislation very closely right now. If things go their way, distilleries around the state will be able to expand sales of their own products. Think of this as the so-called booze bill. Philip McDaniel is CEO of the St. Augustine Distillery, and he's on the phone. Hey, Philip, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Now, you and other distilleries around Florida are really fighting for equal footing with beer and wine producers. There's some legislation that would allow you to expand sales of your own products. Why are they limited now, and what would this change?
Well, they're limited because of these antiquated laws that date back to Prohibition, and what they would change is the number of bottles and how we could get our product direct to consumers the way brewers and wineries can currently do.
Okay, so right now, state law requires bottles of craft liquor to be sold on site but in a separate showroom, and say we come to the St. Augustine Distillery, people could only buy a few bottles at a time. Is that how it works?
Yes, that's right. We're currently, and this is our third time with the legislation in the last 5 years. So it's been an effort and an education at the same time in state bill making. But right now, you can only buy two bottles per person per year per label, and it really limits us, particularly when guests come in from out of state and they want to more. And it's impacting not only our company, but we've got some other great young distilleries, Manifest in Jacksonville and Marlin and Barrel in Fernandina Beach. And we're all hoping to get some of these laws repealed so that we can grow the way brewers have.
How does Florida stack up when it comes to other states and loosening up restrictions on distilleries? This is sort of a growing sector in a lot of cities, not just our area.
No, that's a great question. When we started our company 5 years ago, there were 250 distilleries in the country. Today, there's over 1,600. And so it's like the craft beer industry. It's getting ready to really grow. And Florida, unfortunately, because of the very old and slow-to-change laws that we have, we're really in the back of the bus on this one. And we're hoping to get like states like New York and Oregon and Colorado and Michigan, where they've repealed these laws, where in those other states you can sell without limit, you can have a tasting room where you can own a restaurant, you can in fact have a second tasting room or sell at farmers markets, things that really help build your brand. Mm-hmm. And right now we seem to be having a hard time getting that done here.
Okay, we've got a call for you from David in Jacksonville. Hey, David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, this is David Cohen from owner and head distiller at Manifest Distilling. Just wanted to call in and kind of echo Philip's sentiment on support for this current legislation. And like I said, we're downtown Jacksonville, and the bill like this and previous and future bills do a long way to help us and grow our business, and it makes a big difference for us.
Sure. Thanks for the call. That's our new distillery in downtown Jacksonville. That's David calling from Manifest Distilling. So, Philip, where is the legislation, and what's the next step in the process for this thing?
Well, you know how the legislation works. We have 60 days in an entire calendar year for the legislation to do its thing, and we're down to the last almost 2 weeks. And we've gotten our bill through five committees, and it got the good news is we're moving, which is great. We've got one more committee in the Senate. We passed out of a House committee this morning, and what the bill will bottles to six. We had asked for, unlimited bottles like you can do with breweries. We had asked for ability to get a license to serve a drink by the glass, and we're not going to be able to get that done this year. So wind up with six bottles this year, but it's a step forward, and we're grateful certainly to the legislators, Representative Stevenson, Senator Hudson, Senator Bean in our areas have all been strong advocates for this, and we're grateful for their support.
We'll continue to follow it. Really interesting business story. Thanks so much for getting on the line with us to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Melissa. And if folks out there value small businesses like ours and those at Manifest, the best thing you can do, honestly, is call your state legislator and ask for their support. And if anybody wants to get involved, I'll be happy to give my number, off the air or on the air, but they're happy to call me if they want a guidance of how they can help.
Sure. He's Philip McDaniel, CEO of the St. Augustine Distillery, joining us to talk about legislation that would make the state's distilleries more free to sell their product. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, Democrats are eyeing a handful of districts to help them win back Congress, but is the party strong enough to flip those seats? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.